Harper Audio presents The Claiming of Sleeping Beauty by Anne Rice, writing as A.N. Roquelaure, performed by Samantha Prescott. Preface. I've always loved the fairy tale Sleeping Beauty and found something erotic at its core. The prince awakens beauty with a kiss. And I thought, all right, what if he brought a kind of liberation? An induction into a world of bizarre yet irresistible delights. It has to be remembered that within the frame of a sadomasochistic fantasy like the Beauty Trilogy, the readers are invited to identify with and enjoy the predicament of the slaves. The books aren't about literal cruelty. They're about surrender, the fun of imagining you have no choice but to enjoy sex. Beauty's slavery is delicious. Sensuous, abandoned, and ultimately liberating. This is all part of the framework, and it seemed to work exquisitely with the old fairy tale. And of course, the fairy tale removes us from everyday life. It removes us from the intrusion of garish headlines, literal violence, and all the ugliness of crime. We go into a gilded dream here, luscious and engulfing, in which we're free to imagine all sorts of things. A fairy tale world, indeed. As Anne Rice, I'm known for certain kinds of novels. The Roquelaure books retain the name Roquelaure, even with my name added, to indicate that this is something different. If Anne Rice is one kind of savory dish, well, this is another entirely. And some might find it far too spicy for their taste. I don't like the idea of confusing or disappointing readers, so the pen name helps with that. Of course, there are many people who have read all my work, including the Roquelaure novels, and they see me as a multifaceted writer. But the Roquelaure material is erotica, without reservation, and it needs that pen name on the label, so to speak. The pen name says, Anne Rice is doing something very different here. I felt I needed the anonymity of the pen name to write freely. To pursue an authentic erotica without being inhibited or self-conscious. And it worked wonders to imagine myself cloaked by the name Roquelaure, which is a kind of French cloak, named after the Frenchman who popularized it. My father was still living then, and I didn't want him to know about the books either. In fact, there were lots of friends and relatives whom I didn't want to worry about as I developed the writing. There was quite a bit of exposure involved in writing such graphic sexual fantasies. It was frightening now and then, and it was thrilling. Eventually, I told my father about the books, asking him not to read them, and I did put my name on them. I adjusted completely to people knowing I'd written them, but only after I'd finished with the trilogy, as I recall. A pen name enables you not only to cloak what you are doing from friends and family, it gives you a new freedom to do something you would not do as yourself. I have thought of writing some new erotica, and I must confess, I imagined using a new pen name for it. I don't know whether I'll pursue it, but I do find the freedom of the pen name attractive. When the Sleeping Beauty Chronicle books were first published, they were underground books. They had the backing of a major mainstream publisher, yes, but the publication, though dignified and beautiful, was relatively quiet. But different readers embraced the books almost at once. They clearly appealed to young people, and older married people, to gays and straights, and they've sold steadily ever since they first appeared. Women come up to me at signings with babies in strollers and giggle and laugh and say, "We love your dirty books." People of all ages actually present the books to be signed. Why do I think these particular books have been popular? Two reasons. First, I think it is because they involve no harsh, garish violence at all. They involve game playing, really. No one is burned or cut or hurt. Certainly no one is killed. Indeed, the whole sadomasochistic predicament is presented as a glorified game played out in luxurious rooms and with very attractive people. And involving very attractive slaves. There are endless motifs offered for dominance and submission, for surrender and love. It's like a theme park of dominance and submission, a place to go to enjoy the fantasy of being overpowered by a beautiful man or woman, and delightfully compelled to surrender and feel keening pleasure without the slightest serious harm. I think it's authentic to the way many who share this kind of fantasy really feel. I think what makes it work for people is the combination of the very graphic and unsparing sexual details mixed with the elegant fairy tale world. Unfortunately, a lot of hackwork pornography is written by those who don't share the fantasy, and they slip into hideous violence and ugliness, thinking the market wants all that, when the market never really did. Second, this is shamelessly erotic. It pulls no punches at being what it is. It's excessive, and it is erotica. Before these books, a lot of women read what were called women's romances, where they had to mark the few hot pages in the book. I said, well, look, try this. Maybe this is what you really want. And you don't have to mark the hot pages because every page is hot. Every page is about sexual fulfillment. Every page is meant to give you pleasure. There are no boring parts. Yet it's very romantic. And, well, I think this worked. Lots of people enjoy imagining themselves passive in the hands of a beautiful lover, male or female, who will force them to enjoy themselves. It's a common idea, and it cuts across gender and class. Men love these sorts of fantasies as much as women. And these books offer all kinds of gender combinations, women dominating men and women, men dominating men and women. The books offer ornate and seductive variations on the themes, and all of it is interwoven in stories with real characters, and again, the emphasis is on a lush, sensuous realm in which all of this happens. There are very detailed descriptions of physical interaction and response, but the fairy tale spell is sustained. I also went all the way with exploring the mindset of sadomasochism as I saw it, letting the fantasy characters talk in depth about what they felt and what they enjoyed, and what thrilled them as they were humiliated and overwhelmed. I suspect that for some readers, this kind of deep exploration of the mentality of the participants was entirely new. Is this why they appealed to so many? Because people want this very combination of elements? Perhaps. I certainly never found the combination of elements I wanted in anyone else's erotica. So I offered what I could not find. A light touch, elegance, preciseness, a dreamlike kingdom. A dream in which people explore their need to be passive and to pretend that someone gorgeous and irresistible is making them do it. Psychiatrists have written volumes on the nature of the sadomasochistic fantasy. But when I wrote the trilogy, I don't know of any fiction that really enabled you to slide in it and play the way I wanted to play. So I wrote the books I couldn't find. I never thought a book as eccentric as Interview with the Vampire would have mass appeal. I only knew that I wanted to be with the vampire, in the story, tell it from his point of view. I wanted to be inside his head and heart and reveal his voice and his pain. Now, as it turned out, other people were exploring the same kind of thing. The backstory of the villain, the monster, or the comic book hero and heroine who'd always been described from a distance or in brittle form. People wanted to explore all kinds of super characters and hear their intimate musings. And I began to see more and more of this. Movies made in which Superman could bare his soul and Lois Lane could really talk about what it meant to love him. The demand for such romantic fantasies grew and grew. But did I have any idea that would happen? No. I wrote what I wanted to read. Well, the same thing is true with the beauty books. I didn't know whether that many other people had the fantasies. After all, we didn't talk much about them. Only a small elite knew about the mysterious story of O. But I knew I had these fantasies, and I wanted to share them, and I felt an overwhelming desire to do them right. I didn't want to compromise, water them down, or shrink from the most humiliating detail. I wanted to really delve into intense, sensuous pleasure, but put a gilded frame around a safe place for the reader from which he or she could go and come with ease. Of course, these books have from time to time been banned. I never expected a library to stock the Beauty Trilogy. I know that many libraries respond to community standards, and I just never thought about it much at all. I did notice, and I couldn't help notice, that the books sold well and steadily, and that at every signing I gave, people brought them to be signed. Recently, I've signed as many copies of the beauty books as I have of any other book I've written, so I don't worry too much about being banned. I've always shocked people. Years ago, I published a novel about the 18th-century castrati opera singers, titled Cry to Heaven. Someone brought a copy back to a bookstore in Stockton, California, and demanded his money back. "This is pornography," he said. There are always some people objecting to what I do. I'm grateful the beauty books have been embraced and sustained over the years. As a feminist, I'm very much supportive of equal rights for women in all walks of life. And that includes for me the right of every woman to write out her sexual fantasies and to read books filled with sexual fantasies that she enjoys. Men have always enjoyed all kinds of pornography. How can it be wrong for women to have the same right? We're sexual beings, and fantasy is where we can do the things we can't do in ordinary life. A woman has a right to imagine herself carried away by a handsome prince, and to choose for herself, as she writes, the color of his hair and eyes, and imagine his silky voice. She has a right to make him as tall as she wants and as strong as she wants. Why not? Men have always allowed themselves such fantasies. Famous madams have told us for decades that powerful men love to be dominated and come to them for role-playing that allows the male client to be passive. In fact, some madams have said that men who enjoy playing the passive role are often men who are very powerful in real life. Well, women today are more powerful than ever. They are Supreme Court judges, senators, doctors, lawyers, entrepreneurs, executives, soldiers, cops. They can excel in all walks of life. And why shouldn't they be able to go home from the courtroom, the university, or the office and kick back and pretend they're being swept away to the queen's sadomasochistic kingdom, where all the fairy tale court will watch them being ravaged by the handsome prince? The literary world today is wide open for all kinds of creative endeavors. We are in a new golden age in which fantasy, science fiction, speculative fiction, historical drama, horror, gothic, and supernatural romance are all mainstream. Well, the same holds true now, obviously, for erotica. People in general are out of the closet as enjoyers of erotic books. The novel 50 Shades of Grey has proved this. And I am discovering that the beauty books, in spite of all their playful excess, are for the first time going mainstream. But I wouldn't continue Beauty's story. I felt that ended just the way I wanted. But I might write some more. I don't think I did all I could do in these books, within the fantasy itself, in admitting how much the slaves enjoyed it, how they loved it. I'd deepen that aspect and still keep the tension. If I did them today, people are much more comfortable today admitting and talking about what they enjoy in fiction and film. Much more. People are out of the closet about sexuality, period. The whole world knows that women are sensual human beings just as are men. It's no secret anymore that women want to read sexy fiction just as men do. And there's a new frankness about the varieties of fantasies one might enjoy. So many clichés have been broken and abandoned. And this is a wonderful thing. Anne Rice, June 2012. The Claiming of Sleeping Beauty. The prince had all his young life known the story of Sleeping Beauty. Cursed to sleep for 100 years, with her parents, the king and queen, and all of the court, after pricking her finger on a spindle. But he did not believe it until he was inside the castle. Even the bodies of those other princes caught in the thorns of the rose vines that covered the walls had not made him believe it. They had come believing it, true enough. But he must see for himself inside the castle. Careless with grief for the death of his father, and too powerful under his mother's rule for his own good, he cut these awesome vines at their roots and immediately prevented them from ensnaring him. It was not his desire to die so much as to conquer. And picking his way through the bones of those who had failed to solve the mystery, he stepped alone into the great banquet hall. The sun was high in the sky, and those vines had fallen away, so the light fell in dusty shafts from the lofty windows. And all along the banquet table, the prince saw the men and women of the old court, sleeping under layers of dust, their ruddy and slack faces spun over with spider webs. He gasped to see the servants dozing against the walls, their clothing rotted to tatters. But it was true, this old tale. And, fearless as before, he went in search of the sleeping beauty who must be at the core of it. In the topmost bedchamber of the house he found her. He had stepped over sleeping chambermaids and valets and, breathing the dust and damp of the place, he finally stood in the door of her sanctuary. Her flaxen hair lay long and straight over the deep green velvet of her bed, and her dress, in loose folds, revealed the rounded breasts and limbs of a young woman. He opened the shuttered windows. The sunlight flooded down on her, and approaching her, he gave a soft gasp as he touched her cheek and her teeth through her parted lips, and then her tender, rounded eyelids. Her face was perfect to him, and her embroidered gown had fallen deep into the crease between her legs so that he could see the shape of her sex beneath it. He drew out his sword, with which he had cut back all the vines outside, and, gently slipping the blade between her breasts, let it rip easily through the old fabric. Her dress was laid open to the hem, and he folded it back and looked at her. Her nipples were a rosy pink, as were her lips, and the hair between her legs was darkly yellow and curlier than the long, straight hair of her head, which covered her arms almost down to her hips on either side of her. He cut the sleeves away, lifting her ever so gently to free the cloth, and the weight of her hair seemed to pull her head down over his arms, and her mouth opened just a little bit wider. He put his sword to one side. He removed his heavy armor. And then he lifted her again, his left arm under her shoulders, his right hand between her legs, his thumb on top of her pubis. She made no sound, but if a person could moan silently, then she made such a moan with her whole attitude. Her head fell towards him, and he felt the hot moisture against his right hand. And laying her down again, he cupped both of her breasts and sucked gently on one and then the other. They were plump and firm, these breasts. She'd been 15 when the curse struck her, and he bit at her nipples, moving the breasts almost roughly so as to feel their weight, and then lightly he slapped them back and forth, delighting in this. His desire had been hard and almost painful to him when he had come into the room, and now it was urging him almost mercilessly. He mounted her, parting her legs, giving the white inner flesh of her thighs a soft, deep pinch, and clasping her right breast in his left hand, he thrust his sex into her. He was holding her up as he did this, to gather her mouth to him, and as he broke through her innocence, he opened her mouth with his tongue and pinched her breast sharply. He sucked on her lips. He drew the life out of her into himself, and feeling his seed explode within her, heard her cry out. And then her blue eyes opened. Beauty, he whispered to her. She closed her eyes, her golden eyebrows brought together in a little frown, and the sun gleaming on her broad white forehead. He lifted her chin, kissed her throat, and drawing his organ out of her tight sex, heard her moan beneath him. She was stunned. He lifted her until she sat naked, one knee crooked on the ruin of her velvet gown on the bed, which was as flat and hard as a table. I've awakened you, my dear, he said to her. For 100 years you've slept, and so have all those who loved you. Listen, listen. You'll hear this castle come alive as no one before you has ever heard it. Already a shriek had come from the passage outside. The serving girl was standing there with her hands to her lips. And the prince went to the door to speak to her. Go to your master, the king. Tell him the prince has come who was foretold to remove the curse on this household. Tell him I shall be closeted now with his daughter. He shut the door, bolting it, and turned to look at Beauty. Beauty was covering her breasts with her hands, and her long, straight, golden hair, heavy and full of a great, silky density, flared down to the bed around her. She bowed her head so that the hair covered her. But she looked at the prince, and her eyes struck him as devoid of fear or cunning. She was like those tender animals of the wood just before he slew them in the hunt. Eyes wide, expressionless. Her bosom heaved with anxious breath. And now he laughed, drawing near and lifting her hair back from her right shoulder. She looked up at him steadily, her cheeks suffused with a raw blush. And again, he kissed her. He opened her mouth with his lips and, taking her hands in his left hand, he laid them down on her naked lap, so that he might lift her breasts now and better examine them. Innocent beauty, he whispered. He knew what she was seeing as she looked at him. He was only 3 years older than she had been. 18, newly a man, but afraid of nothing and no one. He was tall, black-haired. He had a lean build which made him agile. He liked to think of himself as a sword, light, straight, and very deft, and utterly dangerous. And he had left behind him many who would concur with this. He had not so much pride in himself now as immense satisfaction. He had gotten to the core of the accursed castle. There were knocks at the door, cries. He didn't bother to answer them. He laid Beauty down again. I am your prince, he said. And that is how you will address me, and that is why you will obey me. He parted her legs again. He saw the blood of her innocence on the cloth, and this made him laugh softly to himself, as again he gently entered her. She gave a soft series of moans that were like kisses to his ear. Answer me properly, he whispered. My prince, she said. Ah. He sighed. That is lovely. When he opened the door, the room was almost dark. He told the servants he would have his supper now, and he would receive the king immediately. Beauty he ordered to dine with him and to remain with him, and he told her firmly that she was to wear no clothing. It's my wish to have you naked and always ready for me, he said. He might have told her she was incomparably lovely, with only her golden hair to clothe her, and the blushes on her cheeks to cover her, and her hands trying so vainly to shield her sex and her breasts. But he didn't say this aloud. Rather, he took her little wrists and held them behind her back as the table was brought in, and then he ordered her to sit opposite. The table was not so wide that he couldn't reach her easily. Touch her, caress her breasts if he liked. And reaching out, he lifted her chin so that he could inspect her by the light of the servants' candles. The table was laid with roast pork and fowl, fruit in big, glistening silver bowls. and immediately the king stood in the door, dressed in his heavy ceremonial robes, a gold crown atop his head as he bowed to the prince, and waited for the command to enter. "Your kingdom has been neglected for 100 years, said the prince as he lifted his wine goblet. "Your vassals have many of them fled to other lords. Good land lies fallow. But you have your wealth, your court, your soldiers. So much lies ahead of you."
"I am in your debt, prince," the king answered.
"But will you tell me your name? The name of your family?" "My mother, Queen Eleanor, lives on the other side of the forest," said the prince. "In your time, it was my great-grandfather's kingdom. He was King Heinrich, your powerful ally."
The prince saw the king's immediate surprise and then his look of confusion.
The prince understood it perfectly. And when a blush came to the king's face, the prince said, "And in those times you served your time in my great-grandfather's castle, did you not? And perhaps your queen also?"
The king pressed his lips together in resignation and slowly nodded.
"You are the son of a powerful monarch," he whispered. And the prince could see that the king would not raise his eyes to see his naked daughter, Beauty. "I will take Beauty to serve," said the prince. "She is mine now."
He took out his long silver knife and, cutting the hot, succulent pork, he laid several pieces on his own plate. The servants all about him vied with one another to place other dishes near him. Beauty sat with her hands over her breasts again. Her cheeks were moist with tears, and she was trembling slightly.
"As you wish," said the king. "I am in your debt."
"You have your life and your kingdom now," said the prince. "And I have your daughter. I will spend the night here, and tomorrow set out to make her my princess across the mountains."
He had placed some fruit on his plate and other hot morsels of cooked food. And now he snapped his fingers gently and in a whisper told Beauty to come around the table to him. He could see her shame before the servants, but he brushed her hand away from her sex.
"Never cover yourself like that again," he said.
He spoke these words almost tenderly as he lifted her hair back from her face.
"Yes, my prince," she whispered. She had a lovely little voice. "But it's so difficult."
"Of course it is," he smiled. "But for me, you'll do it." And now he took her and placed her on his lap, cradling her in his left arm. "Kiss me," he said. And feeling her warm mouth on his again, he felt his desire rising too soon for his taste. But he decided he could savor this slight torment.
"You may go," he said to the king. "Tell your servants to have my horse ready in the morning. I won't need a horse for Beauty. My soldiers you've found, no doubt, at your gates." And the prince laughed. "They were afraid to come in with me. Tell them to be ready at dawn, and then you can say goodbye to your daughter, Beauty."
The king glanced up very quickly to accept the prince's commands, and with unfailing courtesy, he backed out of the doorway. The prince turned his full attention to Beauty. Lifting a napkin, he wiped at her tears. She kept her hands obediently on her thighs, exposing her sex, and he observed that she did not try to hide her stiff little pink nipples with her arms, and he approved of this.
"Now don't be frightened," he said to her softly, feeding a little on her trembling mouth again, and then slapping her breasts so they shivered lightly. "I could be old and ugly."
"Ah, but then I could feel sorry for you," she said in a sweet, tremulous voice.
He laughed. "I'm going to punish you for that," he said to her tenderly. "But now and then, just a little very ladylike impertinence is amusing." She blushed darkly, biting her lip.
"Are you hungry, beautiful one?" he asked.
He could see she was afraid to answer. "When I ask, you will say, 'Only if it pleases you, my prince,' and I shall know the answer is yes. Or,
Not unless it should please you, my prince.
And I shall know the answer is no. Do you understand me?
Yes, my prince, she answered. I'm hungry only if it pleases you.
Very good.
Very good, he said to her with genuine feeling. He lifted a small cluster of glistening purple grapes and fed them to her one by one, taking the seeds out of her mouth and casting them aside. And he watched with obvious pleasure as she drank deeply from the wine cup he held to her lips. Then he wiped her mouth and kissed her. Her eyes were glistening, but she had stopped crying. He felt the smooth flesh of her back and her breasts again. Superb, he whispered. And were you terribly spoilt before?
And given everything that you wished?
She was confused, blushing again. And then, full of shame, she nodded. Yes, my prince, I think perhaps.
Don't be afraid to answer me with many words, he coaxed, as long as they are respectful. And never speak unless I speak to you first. And in all these things, be careful to note what pleases me. You were very spoilt, given everything.
But
were you willful?
No, my prince, I don't think I was that, she said. I tried to be a joy to my parents.
And you'll be a joy to me, my dear, he said lovingly.
Still holding her firmly in his left arm, he turned to his supper. He ate heartily, pork, roast fowl, some fruit, and several cups of wine. Then he told the servants to take it all away and leave them. New sheets and coverlets had been laid on the bed. There were fresh down pillows and roses in a vase nearby, and several candelabra. Now, he said as he rose and set her before him, we must get to bed as we have a long journey before us tomorrow, and I have still to punish you for your earlier impertinence. Immediately the tears stood in her eyes. She looked up at him, imploring. She almost reached to cover her breasts and her sex, and then remembering herself, she made her hands into two little helpless fists at her sides. I won't punish you very much, he said gently, lifting her chin. It was just a little offense, and your first after all. But beauty, to confess the truth, I shall love punishing you. She was biting her lip, and he could see she wanted to speak, and the effort to control her tongue and her hands was almost too much for her. All right, lovely one, what do you want to say? He asked.
Please, my prince, she begged. I'm so afraid of you.
You'll find me more reasonable than you expect, he said. He removed his long cloak, tossing it over a chair, and bolted the door. Then he snuffed all but a few candles. He would sleep in his clothes as he did most nights, in the forest or in the country inns, or in the houses of those humble peasants at which he sometimes stopped. And that was no great inconvenience to him. And as he drew near her now, he thought he must be merciful and make her punishment quick. And seating himself on the side of the bed, he reached out for her. And pulling her wrists into his left hand, he brought her naked body down over his lap so that her legs dangled over the floor helplessly. Very, very lovely, he said, his right hand moving languidly over her rounded buttocks, forcing them ever so slightly apart. Beauty was crying aloud, but muffling her cries into the bed, her hands held out in front of her by his long left arm. And now with his right hand, he spanked her buttocks hard and heard her cries grow louder. It wasn't really much of a slap, but it left a red mark on her. And he spanked her hard again, and he felt her writhing against him, the heat and moisture of her sex against his leg. And again he spanked her. I think you are sobbing more from the humiliation than the pain, he scolded her in a soft voice. She was struggling not to make her cries too loud. He flattened out his right hand and, feeling the heat of her reddened buttocks, drew it up and delivered another series of hard, loud slaps, smiling as he watched her struggle. He could have spanked her much harder, for his own pleasure, and without really hurting her. But he thought the better of it. He had so many nights ahead of him for these delights. He lifted her up now so that she was standing in front of him. "Toss your hair back," he commanded. Her tear-stained face was unspeakably beautiful, her lips trembling, her blue eyes gleaming with the dampness of the tears. She obeyed immediately. "I don't think you are so very spoiled," he said. "I find you very obedient and eager to please, and this makes me very happy." He could see her relief. "Clasp your hands behind your neck," he said, "under your hair. That's it. Very good." He lifted her chin again. "And you have a lovely, modest habit of looking down. But now I want you to look directly at me." She obeyed, shyly, miserably. It seemed she felt her nakedness and her helplessness more fully now as she looked at him. Her lashes were matted and dark, and her blue eyes larger than he had thought. "Do you find me handsome?" he asked her. "Ah, but before you answer, I should like to know the truth from you. Not what you think I should like to hear, or what would be best for you to say, you understand me?"
"Yes, my prince," she whispered. She seemed calmer.
He reached out, massaged her right breast lightly, and then stroked her downy underarms, feeling the little curve of the muscle there beneath the tiny wisp of golden hair. And then he stroked that full, moist hair between her legs so that she sighed and trembled. "Now," he said, "answer my question and describe what you see. Describe me as if you had only just met me and were confiding in your chambermaid." Again she bit her lip, which he dearly loved. And then, her voice a little diminished by uncertainty, she said, "You are very handsome, my prince. No one could deny that. And for one...
"Go on," he said.
He drew her just a little closer so that her sex was against his knee. And putting his right arm about her, he cradled her breast in his left hand and let his lips touch her cheek. "And for one so young to be so commanding," she said, "it's not what one might expect."
"And tell me, how does that show itself in me, other than my actions?"
"Your manner, my prince," she said, her voice gaining a little strength. "The look of your eyes, such dark eyes, your face, there are none of the doubts of youth in it." He smiled and kissed her ear. He wondered why the wet little cleft between her legs was so very hot. His fingers could not keep from touching it. Twice already he'd had her today, and he would have her again. But he was thinking he should go about it more slowly.
"Would you like it if I were older?" he whispered.
"I had thought," she said, "that it would be easier to be commanded by one so very young," she said, "is to feel one's helplessness."
It seemed the tears had welled up and were spilling out of her eyes, so he pushed her gently back so he might see them.
"My darling, I have awakened you from a century's sleep and restored your father's kingdom. You're mine, and you won't find me such a hard master. Only a very thorough master. When you think night and day and every moment only of pleasing me, things will be very easy for you." And as she struggled not to look away, he could see again the relief in her face, and that she was in complete awe of him. "Now," he said, pushing his left fingers between her legs and drawing her close again so that she let out a little gasp before she could stop herself, "I want more of you than I've had before. Do you know what I mean, my sleeping beauty?" She shook her head. For this moment she was in terror. He lifted her up onto the bed and laid her down.
The candles threw a warm, almost rosy light over her. Her hair fell down on either side of the bed, and she seemed on the verge of crying out, her hands struggling to keep still at her sides. "My darling, you have a dignity about you that shields you from me, much like your lovely golden hair shrouds you and shields you. Now, I want you to surrender to me. You'll see, and you'll be very surprised that you wept when I first suggested it." The prince bent over her. He parted her legs. He could see the battle she fought not to cover herself or turn away from him. He stroked her thighs. Then, with his finger and thumb, he reached into the silky, damp hair itself and felt those tender little lips and forced them very wide open. Beauty gave a terrible shudder. With his left hand, he covered her mouth, and behind his hand, she cried softly. It seemed easier for her with him covering her mouth, and that was all right for now, he thought. She shall be taught everything in time. And with his right fingers, he found that tiny nodule of flesh between her tender nether lips, and he worked it back and forth until she raised her hips, arching her back in spite of herself. Her little face under his hand was the picture of distress. He smiled to himself. But even as he smiled, he felt the hot fluid between her legs for the first time. The real fluid, which had not come before with her innocent blood. "That's it. That's it, my darling," he said. "And you mustn't resist your lord and master. Now he opened his clothing and took out his hard, eager sex, and mounting her, he let it rest against her thigh as he continued to stroke her and work her. She was twisting from one side to the other, her hands gathering up the soft sheets at her sides into knots, and it seemed her whole body grew pink, and the nipples of her breasts looked as hard as if they were tiny stones. He could not resist them. He bit at them with his teeth, playfully, not hurting her. He licked them with his tongue, and then he licked her sex, too, and as she struggled and blushed and moaned beneath him, he mounted her, slowly. Again she arched her back. Her breasts were suffused with red. And as he drove his organ into her, he felt her shudder violently with unwilling pleasure. An awful cry was muffled by the hand over her mouth. She was shuddering so violently it seemed she all but lifted him on top of her. And then she lay still, moist, pink, with her eyes closed, breathing deeply as the tears flowed silently. "That was lovely, my darling," he said. "Open your eyes." She did it timidly. But then she lay looking up at him. "This has been so hard for you," he whispered. "You could not even imagine these things happening to you. And you are red with shame and shaking with fear. And you believe perhaps it's one of the dreams you dreamed in your 100 years. But it's real, Beauty," he said. "And it is only the beginning. You think I've made you my princess, but I've only started. The day will come when you can see nothing but me as if I were the sun and the moon, when I mean all to you, food, drink, the air you breathe. Then you will truly be mine. And these first lessons and pleasures," he smiled, "will seem like nothing." He bent over her. She lay so very still, gazing up at him. "Now kiss me," he commanded. "And I mean, really, kiss me." The Journey and the Punishment at the Inn. The next morning, all the court was gathered in the great hall to see the prince off, and all of the court, including the grateful king and queen, stood with their eyes down, bowing from the waist as the prince came down the steps with the naked beauty walking behind him.
He had commanded her to clasp her hands on the back of her neck beneath her hair, and to walk just a little to his right so that he might see her in the corner of his eye. And she obeyed, her bare feet making not the slightest sound on the worn stone steps as she followed him. "Dear prince," said the queen, when he reached the great front door and saw that his soldiers stood mounted on the drawbridge, "we are in your eternal debt, but she is our only daughter." The prince turned to look at her. She was yet beautiful, though more than twice beauty's age, and he wondered if she too had served his great-grandfather. "How can you question me?" the prince asked patiently. "I have restored your kingdom, and you know full well, if you remember anything of the ways of my land, that beauty will be much enhanced by her service there." Then the telltale blush came to the queen as it had to the king before, and she bowed her head in acceptance. "But surely you will allow beauty some clothing," she whispered, "at least until she reaches the border of your kingdom. All those towns between here and my kingdom have owed their allegiance to us for a century, and in each I will proclaim your restoration and new dominion. Can you ask for more than that? The spring is warm already. Beauty shall suffer no ill effects from serving me immediately." "Forgive us, your highness," the king hastened to say. "But is it the same in this age? Beauty's servitude will not be forever?" "It is the same now as it was always. Beauty will be returned in time, and she shall be greatly enhanced in wisdom and beauty. Now, tell her to obey as your parents commanded you to obey when you were sent to us." "The prince speaks the truth, Beauty," the king said in a low voice, still unwilling to look at his daughter. "Obey him. Obey the queen. And though you find your servitude surprising and difficult at times, be confident you will return, as he says, greatly changed for the better." The prince smiled. The horses were restless on the drawbridge. The prince's charger, a black stallion, was particularly hard to restrain, so the prince, bidding them all farewell again, turned and picked up Beauty. He heaved her easily over his right shoulder, clasping her ankles to his waist, and heard her cry out softly as she fell over his back. He could see her long hair sweep the ground just before he mounted the stallion. All the soldiers fell into place behind him. He rode into the forest. The sun spilled down in glorious rays through the heavy green leaves. The sky, now brilliant and blue overhead, only to vanish in a shifting, green-tinted light as the prince rode on at the head of his soldiers, humming to himself, and now and then singing. Beauty's lithe, warm body swayed slightly over his shoulder. He could feel her trembling, and he understood her agitation. Her naked buttocks were still red from the spanking he had given her, and he could well imagine the succulent vision she was to the men who rode after him. As he walked his horse through a dense glade where the fallen leaves were thick and red and brown beneath him, the prince tied the rein on his saddle, and with his left hand felt the soft, hairy little pelt between Beauty's legs, and leaned his face against her warm hip, kissing it gently. After a while, he pulled her down into his lap, turning her as before so she rested against his left arm, and he kissed her red face and brushed the long golden strands of her hair away from it, and then he suckled her breasts almost idly as though taking little drinks from them. "Put your head on my shoulder," he said, and she inclined to him obediently at once. But when he went to sling her over his shoulder again, she gave a little desperate whimper. He did not allow this to stop him. And having her firmly in place, her ankles clasped to his hip, he scolded her lovingly and gave her several hard spanks with his left hand until he heard her crying. "You must never protest," he repeated. "Not with sound, not with gesture. Only your tears may show your prince what you feel, and never think that he does not wish to know what you feel. Now, respectfully, answer me.
Yes, my prince,
Beauty whimpered softly. He thrilled at the sound of it. When they came to the small town in the middle of the forest, there was great excitement, as everyone had already heard of the enchantment being broken. And as the prince rode into the crooked little street with its high, half-timbered houses blocking out the sky, people ran to the narrow windows and doorways. They crowded into the cobblestone alleyways. Behind him, the prince could hear his men in hushed voices telling the townspeople who he was, that it was their lord who had broken the enchantment. The girl he carried with him was the Sleeping Beauty. Beauty was sobbing softly, her body struggling with these sobs, but the prince held her firmly. Finally, with a great crowd following him, he arrived at the inn, and his horse, with loud clops, entered the courtyard. His page quickly helped him down. "We'll stop only for food and drink," said the prince. "We can go miles before sundown." He stood Beauty on her feet and watched with admiration as her hair fell down around her. And he turned her around twice, pleased to see she kept her hands clasped behind her neck and her eyes down as he looked at her. He kissed her devotedly. "Do you see how they all look at you?" he said. "Do you feel how they admire your beauty?" "They are adoring you," he said. And opening her lips again, he sucked another kiss out of her, his hand squeezing her sore buttocks. It seemed her lips clung to his as if she were afraid to let him go. And then he kissed her eyelids. "Now, everyone is going to want to have a look at Beauty," the prince said to the captain of his guard. "Bind her hands over her head by a rope from the sign over the inn gate, and let the people have their fill of her. But no one is to touch her. They can look all they like, but you stand guard and see that no one touches her. I'll have your food sent out to you."
"Yes, my lord," said the captain of the guard.
But as the prince gently gave Beauty over to him, she leaned forward, her lips out to the prince, and he received her kiss gratefully.
"You're very sweet, my darling," he said.
"Now, be modest and very, very good."
"I should be very disappointed if all this adulation made my beauty vain."
He kissed her again and let the captain have her. Then, going inside and ordering his meat and ale, the prince watched through the diamond-paned windows. The captain of the guard did not dare touch Beauty except to put the rope about her wrists. He led her by this to the open gate of the courtyard, and throwing the rope up over the iron rod that held the sign of the inn, he quickly secured her hands above her head so that she was almost on tiptoe. Then he motioned for the people to move back, and he stood against the wall with his arms folded as they pressed to look at her. There were buxom women with stained aprons, and coarse men in breeches and heavy leather shoes, and the young, well-to-do men of the town in their velvet cloaks, with their hands on their hips as they eyed Beauty from a distance, unwilling to elbow in the crowd. And several young women, their elaborate white headdresses freshly done up, who had come out lifting their hems fastidiously as they looked at her. At first everyone was whispering, but now people began to speak more freely. Beauty had turned her face into her arm and let her hair shield her face, but then a soldier came out from the prince and said, "His Majesty said to turn her and lift her chin so they might have a better look at her." An approving murmur went up from the crowd.
"Very, very lovely," said one of the young men.
"And this is what so many died for," said an old cobbler.
The captain of the guard lifted Beauty's chin and, holding the rope above her, said gently, "You must turn around, princess."
"Oh, please, captain," she whispered.
"Don't make a sound, princess, I beg you. Our lord is very strict," he said, "and it's his wish that everyone admire you."
Beauty, her cheeks flaming,
obeyed, turning so the crowd could see her reddened buttocks, and then again to show her breasts and her sex as the captain kept his finger under her chin lightly. It seemed she breathed deeply as though trying to remain very calm. The young men were calling her beautiful and saying her breasts were magnificent.
"But such buttocks," whispered an old woman nearby. "You can see that she's been spanked. I doubt the poor princess did anything much to deserve it."
"Not much," said a young man near her, "except have the most beautiful and pertly shaped buttocks imaginable."
Beauty was trembling.
Finally, the prince himself came out, ready to leave, and seeing the crowd as attentive as before, he himself took the rope down, and, holding it like a short leash above Beauty's head, he turned her. He seemed amused by the crowd's grateful nods and thanks and bows to him, and very gracious in his generosity.
"Lift your chin, Beauty. I shouldn't have to lift it," he reproved her with a little deliberate frown of disappointment.
Beauty obeyed, her face so red that her eyebrows and eyelashes gleamed golden in the sun, and the prince kissed her.
"Come here, old man," the prince said to the old cobbler. "Have you ever seen such loveliness?"
"No, your majesty," said the old man.
His sleeves were rolled to the elbows, and his legs were slightly bowed. His hair was gray, but his green eyes gleamed with a special, almost wistful pleasure.
"She is truly a magnificent princess, your majesty.
Worth all the deaths of those who tried to claim her."
"Yes, I suppose so. And worth all the bravery of the prince who did claim her," smiled the prince. Everyone laughed politely, but they couldn't conceal their awe of him. They were staring at his armor, at his sword, and above all at his young face and dark black hair that fell to his shoulders. The prince drew the cobbler closer.
"Here," he said, "I give you permission, if you like, just to feel her treasures." The old man smiled at the prince gratefully and almost innocently.
He reached out and, hesitating a moment, felt Beauty's breasts. Beauty shivered and tried obviously to repress a little cry. The old man touched her sex. Then the prince drew up her little leash so she was standing on tiptoe. Her body stiffened and seemed to grow more tense and at the same time more lovely. Breasts and buttocks high, her calf muscles lifted, her chin and throat a perfect line down to her swaying bosom.
"That's all. You must all go now," said the prince.
Obediently, they backed away, but they continued to watch as the prince mounted his horse and, instructing Beauty to clasp her hands behind her neck, he ordered her to walk before him. Beauty led the way out of the inn yard, the prince walking his horse behind her. The people made way for her. They couldn't take their eyes off her lovely, vulnerable body, and they squeezed against the narrow walls of the town to follow the spectacle to the edge of the forest. When they had left the town behind, the prince told Beauty to come to him. He gathered her up and seated her before him again, and kissed her again, and scolded her. "You found that so hard," he crooned. "Why were you so proud? Did you think yourself too good to be shown to the people?"
"I'm sorry, my prince," she whispered.
"Don't you see, if you think only of pleasing me and pleasing those to whom I show you, it will be simple for you." He kissed her ear, holding her tight to his chest.
"You should have been proud of your breasts and your shapely hips. You should have asked yourself, am I pleasing my prince? Do the people find me pleasing?"
"Yes, my prince," Beauty said meekly.
"You are mine, Beauty," the prince said a little more sternly, "and there is no command that you must shrink from obeying ever. If I tell you to please the lowliest vassal in the field, you will strain to obey me perfectly. He is your lord then, because I have said so.
All those to whom I offer you are your lords.
Yes, my prince, she said, but she was in great distress.
He stroked her breasts, pinching them firmly now and then, and kissed her until he could feel her body struggling against him, and feel her nipples growing hard. It seemed she wanted to speak.
What is it, beauty?
Pleasing you, my prince, pleasing you, she whispered, as though her thoughts had spread into a delirium.
Yes, pleasing me. That is your life now. How many of those in the world know such clarity, such simplicity? You please me, and I shall always tell you exactly how to please me.
Yes, my prince, she sighed, but she was crying again.
I will treasure you all the more for it. The girl I found in the castle room was nothing to me, such as you are now, my devoted princess. But the prince was not entirely satisfied with the way in which he was instructing Beauty. He told her when they reached another town at nightfall that he was going to strip a little more dignity away from her to make it easier for her. And while the townspeople pressed their faces to the leaded glass windows of the inn, the prince had Beauty wait on his table. On her hands and knees, she hurried across the rough boards of the inn floor to fetch his plate from the kitchen. And though she was allowed to walk back with it, she was again on all fours to fetch his flagon. The soldiers devoured their supper, throwing silent glances at her by the light of the fire. She wiped the table for the prince, and when a morsel of food spilled from his plate to the floor, he commanded Beauty to eat it. With tears spilling from her eyes, Beauty obeyed, and then he gathered her, still on her knees, into his arms, and rewarded her with dozens of wet and loving kisses. Obediently, she put her arms around his neck. But this little morsel spilling had given him an idea. He ordered her to quickly fetch a plate from the kitchen again, and then told her to lay it on the floor at his feet. He put food for her there from his plate and told her to lift her heavy hair behind her shoulders and eat it only with her mouth. You are my kitten, he laughed gaily, and I would forbid you all those tears if they weren't so beautiful. Do you want to please me?
Yes, my prince, she said.
With his foot, he pushed her plate several paces away and told her to turn her buttocks to him as she continued her meal. He admired it, realizing the red marks from her spanking had almost healed. With the toe of his leather boot, he nudged at the silken hair he could see between her legs, felt the moist, plump lips beneath the hair, and sighed, thinking her so very beautiful. When she had finished her meal, with her lips, she pushed the plate back to his chair as he ordered her to do it, and then he wiped her lips himself and fed her some wine from his cup. He watched her long, beautiful throat as she swallowed and kissed her eyelids. Now, listen to me. I want you to learn from this, he said. Everyone here can see you, all your charms, you're aware of it. But I want you to be very aware of it. Behind you, the townspeople at the windows are admiring you as they did when I brought you through the town. This should make you proud of yourself, not vain, but proud. Proud that you have pleased me and caught their admiration.
Yes, my prince, she said when he paused.
Now think. You are very naked and very helpless, and you are mine completely.
Yes, my prince. She cried softly.
That is your life now, and you are to think of nothing else, and regret nothing else. I want that dignity peeled away from you as if it were so many skins of the onion. I don't mean that you should ever be graceless. I mean that you should surrender to me.
Yes, my prince, she said.
The prince looked up at the innkeeper who stood at the kitchen door with his wife and his daughter. They came to attention at once. But the prince looked only at the daughter. She was a young woman,
very pretty in her own way, though nothing compared to beauty. She had black hair and round cheeks, and a very tiny waist, and she dressed as many peasant women did in a low-cut, ruffled shirt-waist, and a short, broad skirt that revealed her smart little ankles. She had an innocent face. She was watching Beauty in wonder, her big brown eyes moving anxiously to the prince and then shyly back to Beauty, who knelt at the prince's feet in the firelight. "Now, as I told you," the prince said softly to Beauty, "all here admire you, and they enjoy you. The sight of you, your plump little rear, your lovely legs, those breasts which I cannot stop myself from kissing. But there is no one here, not the lowliest, who is not better than you, my princess, if I command you to serve him." Beauty was frightened. She nodded quickly as she answered, "Yes, my prince." And then, very impulsively, she bent and kissed the prince's boot. But then she appeared terrified. "No, that is very good, my darling," the prince, stroking her neck, reassured her. "That is very good. If I allow you one gesture to speak your heart unbidden, it is that one. You may always show me respect of your own accord in that manner." Again Beauty pressed her lips to the leather, but she was trembling. "These townspeople hunger for you, hunger for more of your loveliness," the prince continued. "And I think they deserve a little taste of it that will delight them." Beauty kissed the prince's boot again and let her lips rest there. "Oh, don't think I should really let them have their fill of your charms." "Oh, no," the prince said thoughtfully. "But I should use this opportunity both to reward their devoted attention and teach you that punishment will come whenever I desire to give it. You need not be disobedient to merit it. I will punish you when it pleases me. Sometimes that will be the only reason for it." Beauty couldn't keep herself from whimpering. The prince smiled and beckoned to the innkeeper's daughter. But she was so frightened of him that she didn't come forward until her father pushed her. "My dear," said the prince gently, "in the kitchen have you a flat wooden instrument for shoveling the hot pans into the oven?" There was a faint movement throughout the room as the soldiers glanced at one another. The people outside were pressing closer to the windows. The young girl nodded and quickly returned with a wooden paddle, very flat and smooth from years of use, with a good handle. "Excellent," said the prince. But Beauty was crying helplessly. The prince quickly ordered the innkeeper's daughter to seat herself on the edge of the high hearth, which was the height of a chair, and told Beauty, on her hands and knees, to go to her. "My dear," he said to the innkeeper's daughter, "these good people deserve a little spectacle. Their life is hard and barren. My men deserve it as well. And my princess can well use the chastisement." Beauty knelt, crying before the girl who, seeing what she was to do, was fascinated. "Up over her lap, Beauty," said the prince. "Hands behind your neck, and lift your lovely hair out of the way." "At once," he said almost sharply. Pricked by his voice, Beauty almost scurried to obey. And all those around her saw her tear-stained face. "Keep your chin up like that. Yes, lovely. Now, my dear," said the prince, looking at the girl who held Beauty over her lap and the wooden paddle in the other hand, "I want to see if you can wield that as hard as a man might wield it. Do you think you can do that?" He could not keep from smiling at the girl's delight and desire to please. She nodded, murmuring a respectful reply, and when he gave her the command, she brought the paddle down hard on Beauty's naked buttocks. Beauty couldn't keep still. She struggled to keep quiet, but she couldn't keep still, and finally even the whimpers and moans escaped her. The tavern girl spanked her harder and harder, and the prince enjoyed this, savoring it far more than the spanking he had given Beauty himself. It was because he could see it much better. See Beauty's breasts heaving, and the tears spilling down her face, and her little buttocks straining as if, without moving, Beauty might somehow escape or deflect the girl's hard blows. Finally, when the buttocks were very red but not welted, he told the girl to stop. He could see his soldiers enthralled, and all the townspeople as well. And then he snapped his fingers and told Beauty to come to him. "Now, eat your suppers, all of you. Talk amongst yourselves, do as you like," he said quickly. For a moment, no one obeyed him. Then the soldiers turned to one another, and those outside, seeing that Beauty was retired down to kneeling at the prince's feet, her hair veiling her red face, her raw and stinging buttocks pressed to her ankles, were murmuring and talking at the windows. The prince gave Beauty another drink of wine. He was not sure he was entirely satisfied with her. He was thinking of many things. He called the innkeeper's daughter to him and told her she had been very good, gave her a gold coin, and took the paddle from her. Finally, it was time to go up, and, driving Beauty before him, he gave her a few gentle but brisk spanks to hurry her up the stairs to the bedchamber.